The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Melissa Grimm, and I'm a board member here at the Free Library and very proud of the work that we do here. As you saw in the great video that just aired, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity. We have actually 61 branches throughout the city, including our most recent addition, which is the Rosenbach Museum and Library, which we just merged with. The Free Library is an educational and cultural keystone of our great city. But it's through private support from individuals like you that we are able to do many of the events and activities that we do, particularly our work with helping young children to read, helping teens with their homework after school, helping entrepreneurs grow their businesses, helping new Americans put down roots in the community, and offering incredible programming like tonight's event. So please make a donation at freelibrary.org. It's now truly my pleasure to introduce tonight's author and a friend of mine, called the best writer of sports books in America today by the Boston Globe. I'm pleased to welcome John Feinstein. John is the author of the influential and best-selling book, A Good Walk Spoiled, A Season on the Brink, and over 30 other books that he's written, including, I just learned, Children's Mysteries about sports. I got to know John when he was writing a book called A Caddy for Life about Tom Watson, the golfer's caddy, who died of ALS, which John is actually quite active now in fundraising for, and I got to know him through Tom Watson and Neil Oxman, who are mentioned in the book a lot. John has been a staff columnist for the Washington Post, Sporting News, and Golf Digest, and a regular on-air commentator for the Golf Channel and the Jim Rome Show. He also hosts a three-hour daily radio show on CBS Sports Radio Network, which you can listen to here in Philadelphia on 610 every day from 9 a.m. to noon. In his new book, Where Nobody Knows Your Name, Feinstein follows the ups and downs of a year in the colorful world of minor league baseball, following everywhere from Lehigh Valley to Indianapolis and Raleigh and beyond. Where Nobody Knows Your Name offers an intimate look at a baseball world not normally seen by the fans. And the Wall Street Journal said the book offers, quote, plenty of poignant moments. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming John Feinstein to the Free Library.
Thank you all. Thanks for coming out on a tough night. Appreciate it. I know the weather's not fantastic because I drove through it to get here. But it's always great for me to be in Philly. I have a warm spot in my heart for the city because it's the best college basketball city in America. It's a shame that the best basketball team in town this year was Villanova, including your NBA team. And just for the record, this book is about minor league baseball. It is not about this year's Phillies. Really? Have you read the standings lately? But Ryne Sandberg is prominent in this book because he was managing it in Lehigh Valley when I was researching it. And I will talk about him later. He's a very interesting character. As I'm sure all of you know who are Philly fans, he's not what you would call easygoing. But I will get to that a little bit later, and I will talk about Where Nobody Knows Your Name. But before I get to that and get to baseball, just a little background. My first book was written in 1986. I was 12. It was called A Season on the Brink, and it was about Bob Knight, who I'm sure most of you, if you're sports fans at all, or if you've ever had a chair thrown at you, are familiar with. And when I wrote the book, when the book came out, Bob wasn't especially happy with it. You see, his favorite word rhymes with duck and luck, and he uses it quite often. And I actually probably left 99% of it out of the book. because if I hadn't, I'd still be writing. But he wasn't happy that I did leave in enough of it so that you could understand the way he talks to his players and the way he communicates. And as I said, Bob wasn't very happy as a result. And he told one reporter that I was a pimp. And he told another reporter that I was a whore. And this kind of came to a head. I was being interviewed on NBC by Ahmad Rashad. Most of you are familiar with Ahmad Rashad. This was before he was surgically attached to Michael Jordan. But Rashad says to me, Coach Knight's called you a pimp. He's called you a whore. How do you respond? And I said, well, I wish he'd make up his mind so I'd know how to dress in the morning. I'm still working on that. My wife lays out my clothes most days in order to try to help me out. But the book did extremely well, and it allowed me to go on and pretty much choose the topics I wanted to write about for books. And that's been a joy for me, because I'm not wedded to having to write a book that sells X copies, although obviously my publisher expects me to sell at least close to X copies. But I've gotten to know quite a few characters through the years, great characters in sports. One of my favorites was Jim Valvano. I'm sure many of you are familiar. Jim died 21 years ago, it's hard to believe, of cancer. And many of you, I'm sure, have seen the famous ESPY speech where he basically launched the V Foundation that has since raised about $80 million for cancer research since his death. But Jim was one of the most genuinely funny and entertaining people I've ever met in my life. And it was natural. He was just a natural entertainer. I'm working on a book right now, actually, on Jim and Mike Krzyzewski and Dean Smith, and what happened when the three of them came together in North Carolina in the 1980s. And I was talking to his brother, Bob, and he said that when Jim was a boy, his older brother didn't like taking him along when he went to play ball, because Jim would take over. He would start doing imitations when he was 6-7 years old. And Jim was such a good storyteller that you sometimes doubted whether the story was real or made up, but it almost didn't matter. I'll give you an example. When he first got to North Carolina State in 1981, Dean Smith was basically God in the state of North Carolina at that time. And North Carolina had Sam Perkins on the team, Michael Jordan on the team, James Worthy on the team. They were virtually unbeatable. They won the national championship in 1982. They were in the national championship game in 81. Those were Valvano's first 2 years at NC State. And the first year he was there, they lost to North Carolina by about 30 each time. And after the second 30-point loss, an old state alumnus came up to him, and he's wearing a red jacket, and he says, now, Coach, I know you're a Yankee, and you don't really understand about our rivalries down here, but Coach, we can't be losing to Carolina like this. And Valvano said, no, I get it, believe me, I do. And next year, we're going to do better against the Tar Heels. He says, Coach, you don't understand. If you don't do better, if you don't beat Carolina next year, we're going to kill your dog. And Valvano says, I hear what you're saying. I get that. But I should tell you, I don't have a dog. But believe me, we're going to go after it next year. So the next morning, Valvano wakes up. He goes to the front door to get his newspaper. And he opens the door. And there's a basket on the front steps. And under the blanket in the basket is the cutest little puppy you've ever seen. And around the puppy's neck is a note. It says, don't get too attached. Now, I never knew if that story was really true, but it's certainly worth repeating. And one story about Jim that I know is true, because the other person involved told it to me, Hank Nichols, who's from here in Philadelphia. Some of you may know Dr. Henry Nichols, one of the great basketball referees of all time, taught at Villanova for years. And he's running down the court one night, and he hears Valvano calling his name. And he turns around and says, Jimmy, what is it? He says, Hank, can you give me a technical foul for what I'm thinking? And Nichols says, no, Jimmy, I can't give you a T for what you're thinking. He says, good, in that case, I think you suck. And Nichols said it was such a good line, he couldn't tee him up. I mentioned Mike Krzyzewski a minute ago, and I am a graduate of Duke. Yes, we've got a few Dukies here. Yeah, we've got a few Dukies here. But I actually knew Mike Krzyzewski I saw him play at Army. I'm that old. I knew him when he coached at Army. And when he first got to Duke, people forget, they were terrible. They were 38-47 his first 3 years and lost the last game of his third season, 109-66 to Virginia. And a lot of people thought he was going to get fired, and it was really a struggle. As I said, Dean Smith was God in the state, and he's trying to recruit against him. And Mike tells a story about being on a recruiting visit at the home of a kid named Mark Akers. If you're a real big NBA fan, you might remember him. He played in the league for 4 or 5 years. Good player, obviously, if you made the NBA. And Krzyzewski, as with any coach, figures out about midway through this recruiting visit, it's not going well, and he's not getting this kid. But you got to go through the ritual. So he does, and he's making the pitch. And throughout the entire evening, Mark Akers' mother never says a word. So finally he looks at her and he goes, "Mrs. Akers, is there anything at all you'd like to know about Duke, about our school, our academics, how Mark would fit in with the team, anything at all?" And she says, "No, no, no, I don't need to ask any questions, because the only thing that's important is that Mark go to college somewhere where he'll be close to God." And Krzyzewski said, "Well, if he comes to Duke, God will be coaching 10 miles down the road in Chapel Hill, so you might consider it." He went to Oral Roberts. So it all worked out well for Mark Akers, and ultimately for Mike Krzyzewski, who has won a few games since then in spite of that. I've been fortunate. I'm asked frequently, "What's your favorite sport to cover?" It's really hard for me to answer. Because I think my wife would tell you that if there was a tiddlywinks game going on in the backyard, I'd want to write about it. I've always been passionate about sports. I was saying at dinner tonight that, you know, when I was 12, I was going to be the New York Knicks point guard. By 14, I was going to be the Mets center fielder. Neither worked out. So I wrote about point guards, and I wrote about center fielders. And I've been lucky in that I've been able to take my passion for sports and get paid for it. And I've been around basketball, baseball, football, college and pro, the NBA, obviously. The one sport I haven't been able to write a book about is the NHL. I'd love to write a hockey book because I love hockey, and I already know the title. It would be called Season on the Rink, and maybe it would sell. People got confused. But I bounced around, and that's helped keep me fresh, I think, is moving from sport to sport, not just carving out one niche. And when people say, "What's your favorite sport to cover?" As I said, I love college hoops. I love the Big Five. My wife believes I'm going to leave her someday to live in the Palestra because I love the Palestra so much. It's almost a physical thing with me. But I love baseball. And the one sport, even though I love the sport, the one sport I didn't really enjoy covering, to be honest, was tennis. I wrote a tennis book about 22 years ago. It was called Hard Courts. Sold very well. But tennis players are the single most spoiled group of human beings on earth. And that's saying a lot when you realize there are athletes in other sports too. But getting time and access to tennis players, I mean, literally the president of the United States is easier to get to than most tennis players. And when I was working on my tennis book, Andre Agassi was then a rising star. And Andre had an entourage. I mean, I wish his entourage was here tonight because we wouldn't have any empty seats. It included his agent, his agent's assistant, his racket stringer, his masseuse, his hitting partner, his religious guru, who he once fired after losing a match. It was in Stratton Mountain, Vermont. I'm not making that up. And his brother, who as far as I could see was being paid to be his brother. And I don't know how many of you have had the great pleasure of flying into the airport in Cincinnati. If you have, you know it's across the river in Covington, Kentucky. And one night, Andre was going to play in the tournament in Cincinnati, and he and the entourage fly in very late one night. And when they get off the plane, there was a woman from the tournament who had brought a very large car to pick them up in. And he comes out of the gate and goes right to her and says, "Look, you have got to get security here for me. Because if you don't, I'm going to be mobbed by all my fans going through this airport." And the woman looked at him and said, "Andre, it's 11:30 at night. We're in Kentucky. Unless you've been on Hee Haw lately, no one here is going to mob you." I almost dedicated my tennis book to that woman. I think I probably should have. Before I talk about my most recent book, Where Nobody Knows Your Name, I want to talk about two athletes who you've probably never heard of, unless you read the books that I wrote that they're involved in. One is a guy named Chris Spittler. People always say, who's the athlete you admire the most? Is it Michael Jordan? Is it Tiger Woods? Is it Derek Jeter? Is it any of the other great, John McEnroe, who I had a great relationship with because we're both left-handed, we're both from New York, we both have tempers, and one of us can play tennis. But my answer is always Chris Spittler. And has anybody in this room heard of Chris Spittler? No, so nobody read my book on the Patriot League. Okay, fine. There's one. Two. We're up to two. Can I hear three? Chris Spittler averaged 7 points a game as a high school senior in Buffalo, New York. He was recruited by no Division I schools. One Division III school expressed interest and then told him, no, you're not good enough to play for us. So he went to Holy Cross on an academic scholarship and played junior varsity basketball as a freshman. And at the end of that season, he went into the coach, Bill Rayner, and he said, Coach, I'd like to try out for the varsity next year. Holy Cross wasn't very good at this point. And Bill Rayner said, Chris, you're welcome to try out. Anybody can try out, but I've seen you play. You can't make the team. He said, well, I'd like to try out anyway. So he goes to tryouts, and at the end of the tryouts, Bill Rayner called him in, and he said, Chris, I'm putting you on the team. And the reason I'm putting you on the team is because I love your hustle, I love your attitude, I love your grade point average, because regardless of the school, they want the kids at the end of the bench to have high grade point averages to balance the kids who are playing. That's not true at Duke, of course. But I'm putting you on the team, but I want you to understand, you are the 12th man on a 12-man team. If you should ever find yourself in a game, please remove yourself immediately. Someone's made a terrible mistake. Chris said, that's fine. I just want to be on the team. So sure enough, they're going through the season, and Holy Cross is in last place in the Patriot League, and they're on a bus trip home from Colgate. Have any of you ever been to Colgate? You know how you get there, right? You drive to the end of the earth, you turn right, go about 100 miles, and when it starts snowing in June, you're almost there. So they're on this bus trip coming back from Colgate, and Chris picks up a basketball magazine, and it ranks the 31 Division I conferences from 1 to 31, and ranked 31st is the Patriot League. And he starts thinking about it. He goes, let me see if I have this straight. I'm the worst player on the worst team, in the worst conference. I'm the worst Division I basketball player in America. How about that? And he started to use it as a pickup line. He'd go up to a girl at a party and say, hey, you know who I am? Yeah, you're a loser hitting on me. Yes, but not just any loser. Now, sadly, he lost that status at the end of the season because Bill Rayner got desperate and started him in a game against Bucknell, at Bucknell. And he played 39 minutes, had 11 points, 5 assists, 1 turnover, and fouled out diving for a loose ball. So the last 5 games of the season, he's the starting point guard. Now his junior year, Bill Rayner calls him one day in September, and he says, Chris, aren't you going to try out for the team this year? He says, try out? I'm the starting point guard. No, we have better players this year. You have to try out again. So sure enough, same deal. You're on the team. You're the 12th man. You'll never be in a game. End of the year, he's the starting point guard. Now Bill Rayner gets fired because even in the Patriot League, Ivy League, anybody you want to mention, you lose, you get fired. Nobody ever gets hired or fired based on graduation rates. They get hired and fired based on one-loss records. So Bill Rayner gets fired. And Ralph Willard is hired as the coach. Ralph Willard had coached under both Jim Boeheim and Rick Pitino. He had taken Western Kentucky to the Sweet 16. He coached at Pittsburgh. Now he's coming back to his alma mater, Holy Cross. And the first thing he says after seeing his new team is, we have got to get rid of number 11, whoever that kid is. That was Chris Spittler. And the assistant said, yeah, coach, he's not very talented, but he's really helps the team just by being, no, we don't want him. Okay, he can try out. You know the routine. You're on the team, you're the last guy. And at the end of the season, on senior night, he was the only senior left on the team. He had averaged 1.4 points per game for his career. And if you've ever been to, if you're a basketball fan, you've ever been to a senior night at a college basketball arena, the visiting team usually leaves the court for the senior ceremony. By the way, Dean Smith invented senior night in 1964. It was one of the many things he did that make him extraordinary. That's a whole other story. But Sal Mentisana, who was the coach at Lehigh, kept his team on the court during the senior ceremony because he wanted to make a point to his players that you don't have to be gifted as a player to contribute and to help your team. And so Spittler graduated, and that his senior year was the year I wrote The Last Amateurs, which was my book on Patriot League basketball. And the year after he graduated, he was in law school in New York, and he got an email from a guy, and it said, I just want you to know that we play basketball every Wednesday night at PS 87 on 78th Street. I'm not making this up. That's where I went to elementary school. We're not very good, but I just read this book, and from what I've read, you'd fit right in with us. So would you like to come and play? Spittler wrote back and said, I'll come and play as long as I don't have to try out. Now, he's still playing rec basketball 14 years later. He's a very successful lawyer. The point of the story is this. You don't have to be Michael Jordan. You don't have to be Tiger Woods or Derek Jeter or Peyton Manning or Tom Brady in order to make a contribution, in order to be special. If you take the right approach, you can make a contribution, whether you're an athlete or not, every single day, just by wanting to. And Chris Spittler did that. And that's why I always say he's one of the athletes I admire the most. Now, the other athletes, plural, that I admire are the guys who play football at Army and Navy, or really anybody who plays any sport at Army or Navy, or goes to Army or Navy, or Air Force. And the reason I say that is I did a book in 1995 called A Civil War, and it was about the Army-Navy rivalry, and specifically about the young men who play football at those two academies. Because they love football and cherish football just as much as the guys who play at Alabama or Florida State or any of the big-time schools you might name. But the difference is, unless you're Roger Staubach, who was a once-in-a-lifetime guy, when you graduate from the academies, the only uniform you're ever going to wear is Army, Navy, or Marines, not Eagles, Giants, or the Washington football team, whose nickname I won't mention. But I met all these remarkable young men when I was working on the book. One of them was a guy named Jim Cantaloupe, who was the defensive captain of the team. And actually, his freshman year, when his squad leader lined everybody up one night to haze them the way plebes get hazed at the academies, and he was going down the line and he was demanding to know what their background was. Like, Feinstein, what kind of name is that, sir? It's Russian, sir. You know, O'Reilly, what kind of name is that, sir? It's Irish, sir. Finally got to Cantaloupe. He said, Cantaloupe, what kind of name is that, sir? It's produce, sir. So he did a lot of marching. But when Jim was a senior, and I was researching this book, I spent days, you know, hanging out with cadets and midshipmen from the very start of their day to the very end of their day. And one morning, I went to first period class with Jim, and we came back to his room for second period because he didn't have a class. And his roommate, Kevin Norman, who was a punter on the football team, was there too. And I was sitting on Jim's bed, and Jim was sitting at his desk, and Kevin was sitting across from me on his bed. And a guy came in to do morning room inspection, because when you go to the academies, they inspect your rooms every day. I wouldn't have done very well with that. I wouldn't do very well with that right now. Nor do my children. So he walks through the room with his clipboard, and he's making all these notes. And I see an immaculate room. So finally he walks out, and he leaves the clipboard on the door. And I go to the door because I want to find out what the heck is wrong with this room. And I pick up the clipboard, and sure enough, he's written down uniforms not spaced properly in Cadet Cantaloupe's closet. Too many civilian photos, Cadet Norman's desk. Unknown object on Cadet Cantaloupe's bed. Which I felt pretty good about because I thought that was a lot of progress from being a pimp and a whore to being an unknown object. But the specialness of these kids, tragically, one of the most overused words in sports, by the way, a double fault is not tragic. A golf ball going in the water is not tragic. What's tragic was that 7 years after I wrote this book, Kevin Norman died in Korea. He was flying a plane and came back from, we don't know where exactly, but you can guess it was somewhere in the airspace of North Korea. And something went wrong with the plane. and it was going to crash. And according to the official report, it was going to crash in a very populated area. And Kevin was able to keep the plane aloft long enough to crash it into an empty field. So instead of who knows how many civilians dying, only Kevin and his co-pilot died. And when Jim Cantaloup called me to tell me that Kevin had died, I made the cliche comment, well, he died a hero because he died fighting for his country. And Jim said to me, no, John, that's really not true. Kevin wasn't a hero because he died for his country. Kevin was a hero because he was willing to die for his country. So when people ask me what's the most special event, what if I could only go to one event every year in sports, the answer is not the Final Four, it's not the Masters, it's not the World Series. I love them all, but it's the Army-Navy football game. And if you live in Philadelphia and you haven't been to one, you owe yourself going to it at least once. There's nothing like it. The march-ons, the playing of the alma maters at the end of the game when the players stand together and show respect for the other school's alma mater. But when they play the national anthem at the Army-Navy game, it's like no other national anthem, because when they start the anthem, you see 8,000 hands go like this, 4,000 cadets, 4,000 midshipmen. And if you think about it, you realize that every one of those kids has volunteered to die for his or her country, if they have to. They don't want to, obviously, but they volunteered to do that. And those are people I admire. So, having led up now to my current book, which, as I said, is called Where Nobody Knows Your Name, and the title comes, obviously, it's a ripoff of Cheers, you know that. But where I got the title was being about an hour from here in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Have any of you ever been to the ballpark there? Really neat ballpark, isn't it? It's just a Coca-Cola field is a one stadium is a wonderful ballpark. There's two Coca-Colas in the International League, one in Buffalo, one in Allentown. But I was there on a Saturday night. It was a beautiful Saturday night, and the Iron Pigs are playing the Pawtucket Red Sox. And as you know, if you've been in a minor league park, there is a entertainment of some kind, a promotion of some kind between every half inning. And the promotion going into the bottom of the fourth inning that night was called Whack an Intern. That's not what you think. It's a box that they bring out onto the third baseline, and four summer interns climb into the box. There are four holes, and they pop their heads up out of the box, and two fans take plastic bats and whack the interns. And the fan who whacks the intern the most times wins. So while Whack an Intern is going on, jogging in from the Pawtucket bullpen comes Mark Pryor. Now, if you're a baseball fan, you know Mark Pryor. Mark Pryor was Steven Strasburg 10, 11 years ago. He was 18-6 in his second year in the big leagues in 2003. He was third in the Cy Young voting for the Cubs and was on the mound pitching a shutout during the famous Bartman game in Game 6 of the National League Championship Series in 2003. And he was going to win. My friend Tim Kirkchin, who knows baseball as well as anybody, said Mark Pryor will win at least three Cy Youngs before he's through. He won three less than that because he got hurt, as happens to athletes. He had a hamstring issue that led to a shoulder issue. And now it's 2012, and he's pitching in middle relief for the Pawtucket Red Sox and trying to get one last shot at the major leagues. And as he comes jogging into the bullpen, not a soul in the ballpark notices. And I thought, this really is Where Nobody Knows Your Name. And that's where the title of the book came from, because AAA is such a different life. I mean, we see Major League Baseball players. Now, the minimum salary in the major leagues is $500,000 a year. All right. Now, to put that in a little bit of perspective, one of the guys I write about in this book is a guy named Doug Bernier. Doug Bernier graduated from college, was not drafted. There are 50 rounds in the major league draft. So if you don't get drafted, that's maybe a hint. But he was offered a free agent contract for $850 a month to go to rookie ball for the Colorado Rockies. 7 years later, he had made it up to AAA. And Yorvi Torrealba, who was playing for the Rockies at the time, got into a fight with Matt Kemp and was suspended for 3 days. And the Rockies needed an extra bat or glove up in the major leagues for those 3 days. And Doug Bernier at that time had made it all the way to making $2,100 a month. during the 3 days he was in the major leagues, the minimum salary back then was $432,000 a year, he was paid $2,400 a day. And he said the coolest thing about it was when he got back to Colorado Springs after his 3 days in the majors, he got the first check of his career that had a comma in it. All right. So that pretty much sums up the difference between major league life and minor league life. Now, the thing is, when you're in AAA, you're right there. The saying among AAA players is, quote, you're an accident away. Now, that may sound cruel, but we know players get injured. And when somebody gets injured, somebody goes up. I was actually standing in the Pawtucket Red Sox clubhouse one afternoon, and in all the minor league clubhouses, if the major league team is playing, that game is on the television. You know, they get the baseball package so they can pump in any game. And the Red Sox are playing that afternoon, and Mike Aviles was playing shortstop for the Red Sox at the time. And the guys are sitting around the clubhouse. It's 2 or 3 hours before game time. They've got headphones on, or they're looking at their phones, whatever. They're not really watching the game, but I was standing there with the manager, Arnie Baylor, who's now with the Red Sox as their first base coach. And Mike Aviles has a ground ball hit at him. It takes a bad hop, clocks him on the wrist, and he goes down holding his wrist. And Arnie Baylor says to me, watch this. And sure enough, within 20 seconds, half the clubhouse was standing right in front of the TV set. All the infielders. Because if he had a broken bone, or if he was hurt badly enough that he went on the disabled list, somebody's going up. And Arnie Baylor said, the good news about that is, I get to call a guy in and say, you're going up. The bad news is, there are going to be four other guys saying, why wasn't it me? And the best summary of AAA life I heard came from Buck Showalter. Buck Showalter never made it to the majors as a player, managed in AAA for 4 years. And when I was going off to research this book, the three guys I went to see right away were Buck Showalter, Jim Leland, and Tony La Russa, who were all very successful major league managers. Buck and Jim never played in the majors. Tony was up and down throughout his career, had brief stints in the majors, but was mostly a AAA player. I wanted to get their perspective. What kind of stories do you look for? That kind of thing. And Buck said to me, the hardest job in baseball is being a AAA manager. And I said, why? And he said, because nobody wants to be there. Players, coaches, managers, broadcasters, umpires. Now, a major league umpire makes a minimum salary of $90,000 a year. After you've been up a while, you can make as much as $500,000. But the minimum's $90,000. A AAA umpire, a top AAA umpire, makes $2,200 a month. And needless to say, has to have a job in the offseason. One of the guys I dealt with was Mark Lolo, who was considered the top umpire in the International League the year I was doing the book. He was the crew chief for the League Championship Series and for the All-Star Game. Well, Mark Lolo had been an umpire for 11 years, and he had gotten to the point where he was on what's known as the call-up list. You know, major league umpires now get vacation during the season, and there's a group of umpires, 18 guys, who are available from the minor leagues when guys go on vacation or somebody gets hurt or somebody gets suspended for a reason. Some of them deserve to be suspended. And Mark Lolo had made it to the call-up list in 2011, and he'd worked 8 major league games, and he thought he was close. And then in 2012, he only got 2 major league games. Not a great sign. Because the way it works for umpires, it's not like a player. If a player doesn't make the major leagues, he can stick around, play AAA ball, AA ball, as long as he wants, as long as somebody's willing to employ him. The way it works for umpires is you reach a point where you're up or you're out. You either make it to the majors because they think you're good enough, or they say, no, we don't think you're going to be good enough. You're out. We're bringing a younger guy in to AAA to take your place. And at the end of the 2012 season, after 11 years as an umpire, Mark Lolo was told his services were no longer required. And he had to go start his life over again at the age of 31. Now, athletes do that. But for an umpire who thinks he's reaching his peak years and thinks he's just gotten there to the promised land, to be told, thanks very much, is heartbreaking. And again, there are no options. It's not so one of the things that happens in the minor leagues that's both good and bad, is there are 25 guys on a major league roster. Every major league team has usually 7 minor league affiliates. That's another 175 jobs, give or take, with injuries and things. Well, most of those guys are never going to get to the major leagues. 3% of the guys who are drafted make the major leagues. If you make it to AAA, your odds go up to 1 in 3. But most of them aren't going to make the major leagues. Tommy Lasorda, when he was managing in Spokane, called a clubhouse meeting one day because they had a rookie on the team that year named Bobby Valentine, who had been the 5th pick in the draft and who was a rising star. And everybody on the team hated him for all the same reasons that the Red Sox hated him 2 years ago. And he called the meeting and he said, I want you guys to do two things. First, I want you to go get Valentine's autograph because it's going to be worth something someday. Then I want you to shake his hand and thank him because you need to understand the only reason you guys have a job is because we need a team to play around Valentine. Because every organization needs these guys. They're known as organization players as opposed to prospects. Prospects are guys who the organization thinks really has a chance to play in the major leagues. Is that Bobby Valentine? And organization guys are guys who are there to fill out rosters. And they keep playing, A, because the dream never really dies. They all think they might be Doug Bernier and get those 3 days in the major leagues. And B, because they love to play baseball. It's what they've done. It's who they are. It's very hard to give it up and walk away from it. Now, one of the nice stories about a guy like that, that I actually begin the book with, is about a guy named J.C. Boskin. J.C. Boskin was signed out of Venezuela when he was 16. You know, international players are not subject to the draft. Teams can just go down and draft, scout them when they're kids and sign them. So he signed with the Atlanta Braves when he was 16, and he was going to be a star. Excuse me. He was a big kid, strong kid. He was a catcher. And 14 years later, he's never made it to the major leagues. And he's playing in Gwinnett, Georgia, for the Braves AAA team. And August 31st is a huge day in every minor league clubhouse because September 1, you know, major league rosters can expand from 25 players to as many as 40. Usually 5 or 6 guys get called up. And he had had his best year. He's now 30 years old. And he's thinking to himself, if I don't get called up now, today, tomorrow, by the Braves, I'm never getting to the major leagues. My dream is dead. This is it. And they go out and they play the game. He's sitting in his locker. And sure enough, Jamie Dukes, who was the hitting coach, is walking through the clubhouse and saying to calling guys in to the manager's office, Dave Brundage, who's now managing in Lehigh Valley, actually. And guys are being told you're an Atlanta Brave. One of them was Freddie Freeman, who's now a star for the Braves. 6 guys go in as Gwinnett Braves, come out as Atlanta Braves. Nobody says a word to Boskin. And he thinks, well, that's it. I'm not going to the big leagues. I'm not ever going to the big leagues. And just as he's about to, you know, put on his jacket and get ready to leave the clubhouse, Jamie Dukes comes over to him and kind of with a grim look on his face says, Skip wants to see you. And he thinks, oh, my God, they're releasing me. They're sending me to AA. Oh, my God. And he goes into Brundage's office, and Brundage is sitting there with a very stern look on his face. And he says, J.C., how long have you been a baseball player now? And he says, oh, my God, he's giving me the release speech. He's going to tell me, you know, how lucky I am to have played the game for so long. And he says, 14 years. And all of a sudden, Brundage breaks into a grin. He says, you know what? I was going to give you a hard time. I can see the look on your face. I can't do it. You're going up. Those are the 3 magic words. You're going up. And he bursts into tears because he can't believe it. And the coaches are there, and there are hugs and celebration. And he walks back into the clubhouse. Now, how many of you here have seen the movie The Rookie? Okay, you remember the last scene where he's pitched, just Jimmy Morris has just pitched in the major leagues, and he walks up the ramp with his wife, and the whole town where he's from in Texas is waiting for him. This was just like that because the entire clubhouse was in on it. They had told everybody that Brundage was going to do this. So when he came around the corner out of the manager's office, the whole team was waiting for him. And they had champagne and, you know, poured champagne on his head like he'd won a championship and hugged him and sent him off to the major leagues. And it was a scene literally right out of a movie. It was that good. And those are the moments that keep these guys going. Those are the moments that make them say, I'm going to stick with it, even though I've been in the big leagues for 40, 50, for 10, 11, 12 years, in minor leagues, excuse me, and I'm making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year. They all believe that their time might come the way J.C. Boskin's time came. There's another guy named John Lindsay, not the former mayor of New York, although that's his nickname, the mayor, even though most of the guys who call him that name have no idea why they're calling him that name. He set the record because he went more than 16 years in the minor leagues without getting called up, and then eventually did get called up to the Dodgers. And he got one hit in 12 at-bats, and he said he was so happy that night that Carlos Lee was playing left field for the Houston Astros, because Carlos Lee is not terribly fast. And if it had been a fast left fielder, the bloop that he hit would not have dropped. But it did, and he still has the baseball. The baseball sits in the room of his three-year-old son. That's his one hit in the major leagues. So those are the stories that I enjoyed getting a chance to tell. I'll tell you two more, and then I'll do Q&A. Andy, is that about right on timing? Okay. So one of them is about a guy named Chris Schwinden, and this is the other end of minor league baseball. Chris Schwinden was with the Mets organization. He had made it to the Mets briefly in September of 2011. He started 2012 in Buffalo. And in the first 2 months of the season, he went from Buffalo to New York to Buffalo to New York to Buffalo to New York to Buffalo. This is right around now, the first week in June. And he pitched a game here in Philadelphia. Came out of the bullpen here in Philadelphia, a game the Mets were losing by a lot, and did not pitch particularly well. And after the game, he's expecting to get sent down to Buffalo, except he wasn't. He was told he was being designated for assignment, which is the euphemism now in baseball for you're being released. So he doesn't know what to do. He goes to the airport. He's in here in Philly. He's going to go back to Buffalo and go to his apartment, get his stuff, and then doesn't know where he's going from there. As he's going through the airport, he gets a call from his agent saying, go to Las Vegas. The Toronto Blue Jays have picked you up. Goes to Las Vegas, pitches once. He's released again. Agent calls again. Go to Columbus. You've been picked up by the Cleveland Indians. Goes to Columbus, pitches three times there, gets released again. Agent calls again. Go to Scranton, Wilkes-Barre. You've been picked up by the Yankees. He goes to Scranton. Actually, not to Scranton, because they weren't playing any home games that year. He went to Rochester because they were renovating the stadium. So he's now, you know what the agate type is in the newspaper, transactions? He's now been in the agate 16 times since the season began. You know, sent, brought up from Buffalo, sent back, released, signed. He pitches once for Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, released again. Gets a phone call, the Mets have re-signed you. Go back to Buffalo. This happened in 35 days. It's the only person perhaps in the history of the world who ever kissed the ground upon arriving in Buffalo. And pitched actually pretty well the rest of the season with a 2.70 ERA. For the Bisons. On Sandberg, I don't know what's going to happen here in Philly. Obviously, a lot has to change on the roster. The Phillies are an older team. They've had great success. They've wanted to hold on to some of their older guys. But there's one brief story that kind of sums up who Sandberg is, and you guys have had him as your manager now since last July, so you'll understand it. I was sitting in a dugout with him in Lehigh Valley, and players were coming out to stretch. It was early on a Sunday morning, and I said to him, so Ryan, what happens if somebody's late to stretch? And he looked at me like I had said, so Ryan, what happens when you take your daily trips to Mars? And he just looked at me with those steely eyes, and he said, that would never happen. So when I heard what was going on with Jimmy Rollins in spring training, I said, yeah, I believe it all. And we will see what happens with him. I hope he does well, because even though I grew up in New York and even though I'm a lifelong Mets fan, you can boo me if you want. Thank you. You boo a Mets fan? You know, you should have some sympathy, for crying out loud. I mean, do you remember 2007? Okay, let me tell you one story about the Mets and Phillies that you'll remember, and then I'll take questions. 2007, I was doing a book on Tom Glavine and Mike Mussina. And the Mets that year, you may remember, had a 7-game lead on the Phillies with 17 games to play. And sure enough, they blow the lead, and we come to the last day of the season. and they're tied with the Phillies, and Glavin's pitching for the Mets. And so I'm at Shea Stadium, and friends of mine are coming up and saying, how lucky are you? You're writing a book on Glavin and Messina, and Glavin's pitching the game that'll either make or break their season. Glavin pitched a third of an inning that day, gave up 7 runs, came out after hitting Dontrell Willis with a pitch, who I also encountered in AAA while I was working on Where Nobody Knows Your Name. And after the game, because Tom is a very smart, reasoned guy, he was asked by a reporter, because the Phils won that day and won the East, how devastating is this? And Tom said, you know, losing a baseball game isn't devastating. A child with cancer is devastating. Losing a baseball game is disappointing. Now, Tom's right. He's absolutely right. But there were 55,000 people driving out of the parking lot at that moment who were devastated. So when I wrote the book, one of the people I sent it to was Gary Cohen, who does the Mets games on TV, who's a longtime friend of mine and who I think is great at what he does. And Gary wrote me a note back saying, you know, John, I've read all your books. Maybe it's because I'm familiar with the subject, but I think this is your best book. I love it. And I wrote back and I said, gee, Gary, I'm so thrilled to hear that. Do you think I could come on for an inning during a game to talk about the book? And he wrote me back. He said, John, I love the book and I love you. There's not a single Met fan alive who ever wants to hear the name Tom Glavin again. I don't think we can do that. By far the worst selling book I've ever written, because Messina was brutal that year. He pitched to a 5.12 ERA and Glavin was the GOAT. So the main market for that book was what? New York. Nobody in New York wanted to read it. It was a pretty good book, too. Anybody have a question?
I'd like to know what prompted you to start writing young adult books.
Oh, very good question. Thank you for asking. When my son Danny was, this is 10 years ago, was 10, he wanted to start reading some of my books. And he came to me and said, Dad, what's your first book? Well, my first book was Season on the Brink. I didn't think that was a great starter book for a 10-year-old. So he and I had read together Carl Hiaasen's children's book, Hoot, and were represented by the same, Carl and I are represented by the same agent. So I called Esther's assistant, a woman named Christine Bauck, and said, you know, I'd like to get Carl's email, drop him a note, and tell him how much we enjoyed this book. And Christine, whose name is now Christine Feinstein, said, you know, you tell stories about your children all the time. Why don't you think about doing a kid's book? And so I've always believed that the best fiction reads like nonfiction, that it sounds real, so you should write about something you know something about. And I'd been to the Final Four about 100 times back then, and so I came up with this idea to set a book at the Final Four, created these two characters, a 13-year-old boy and girl, who win a writing contest, get to go to the Final Four. And the writing contest actually exists. And when you win, you get to go to the Final Four with a media credential. So I sent them to the Final Four, having won this writing contest, and they stumbled into a scandal involving trying to fix the championship game. And the book did really well. It was a bestseller. It won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for mystery writing in the young adult category. And so now I've written 8 of them. And that's not why I married Chris, by the way. Not because she came up with that idea. She's also really good looking. That's how it got started. Sure. This side, yes. Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is kind of an elementary question, but I'm an old journalism major, so I'm anxious to hear your answer. So much of what you write is, you know, anecdotal and obviously, you have long conversations with people to come up with these gems. What are you just conversing, or do you have? Are you tape recording it, or do you have the old-fashioned notebook?
I actually do both. I always have a tape recorder running, and I try to take some notes during the course of the conversation. There are times, in order to make it more casual, when I'll just kind of sit there and make sure the tape is working. The one time that the tape broke on me, I was interviewing Steffi Graf. And I got back in the second half of the, I was with her for like 4 hours. And the last tape had completely broken. And thank God she was gracious. And I told her what happened, and she sat down with me for another hour and a half. You could also say I just used it as an excuse to sit with Steffi Graf for another hour and a half, but if it had been Agassi, I might have just said, screw it. And the one time, the angriest I think I've ever gotten, I was interviewing Jack Morris, the great pitcher. We're sitting in a dugout in Baltimore, and Jack was sitting here, and I was sitting there, and the tape recorder was right between us, and he was talking about his divorce. And it had come right after that 1991 World Series when he had pitched that historic game for the Twins against the Braves. And he was getting very emotional. And all of a sudden, I hear a voice saying, Black Jack Morris, hero of the 1991 World Series. And I look up, it's Chris Berman. And, you know, he didn't care that somebody was clearly having a one-on-one conversation. And the tape recorder's right there. And, of course, Morris breaks off to say hello to Jack Morris and completely lost it after that. You know, the train of thought was gone. The emotion was gone. And after we were done, I went over to Berman at the batting cage. And I said, Chris, did you happen to see that I was trying to conduct an interview there? And he said, well, you know, it's not that big a deal. I said, really? So if you were interviewing Jack Morris on camera, and I walked over, and I just walked into your shot and said, Black Jack Morris, it's great to see you. And he says, well, that's different. I said, no, it's not. And the problem is you think it's different. So the long-winded answer to your question is, yes, I tape my interviews. And thank God I have Bob Knight on tape. Although it's hard to listen to sometimes. Yes, sir.
John, I was talking to an orthopedic surgeon today who loves baseball. And incidentally, he had just done Tommy John surgery on a 13-year-old.
Yeah, if you're an orthopedic surgeon, you do them about three a day these days.
And I asked him, having grown up in Philadelphia where Robin Roberts completed 29 games a year, Don Newcomb pitched a doubleheader, what's happened to today's pitchers? And he said, one, the strike zone was so much larger back then. But he had spoken to Warren Spahn, and he told him that these pitchers today don't pace themselves. He never started pitching like he did in the middle innings, Warren Spahn said. He started off slowly, worked his way up. His middle innings were the best. What's your opinion today about these?
You know, there's about 100 theories, at least, on why so many of these young pitchers are undergoing Tommy John surgery. And you're right. You know, in the old days, guys pitched 300-plus innings routinely. And now, if you pitch 200 innings, that's a big deal. Now, one of the reasons pitchers don't pace themselves is because they know they're coming out in the sixth or seventh inning. Nobody pitches complete games anymore. You know, there's one guy in the major leagues right now, we're 2 months into the season with three complete games. One. And there have been teams that have gone entire seasons without a complete game. But I think, and I'm not the only one who thinks this, that it gets back to the way we've changed as a society in that when I was a kid, I played football in the fall, basketball in the winter, baseball in the spring. Then when I became a swimmer, I swam in the wintertime instead of playing basketball. We all played three sports. Now, they decide by the time you're 10 years old, this is your sport. And you play it 12 months a year. You have these travel teams in the summer. Kids are pitching in 100-plus games. The most games I ever played in a high school baseball season was 22. And that was it. And I was a left-handed pitcher. Now, I couldn't pitch very well, but my elbow's fine today. I still can't throw very well, but nevertheless, I think these kids are being overpitched and overstressed. Because if you've ever been to a little league baseball game or, you know, youth basketball or peewee football or youth tennis or golf, the parents are insane. And I mean, you know, my brother, who has been around me all his life and knows how I feel about stuff like this, I go to see his sons play basketball sometimes, and he and his wife are screaming at the referees. And I say, Bobby, that's crazy. And he goes, well, they missed the call. I said, that doesn't matter. That's not why they're playing. So I think that because everybody now plays sports all year round, plays a sport all year round, they are more susceptible to injuries, particularly young pitchers, because the body simply wasn't meant to do what you do when you pitch a baseball. The arm and the elbow, the shoulder and the elbow were not meant to do that. That's my theory.
Getting back to the Phillies for a minute.
You really want to do that?
Why can't we just blow up the team?
Well, you should have blown up the team 2 years ago.
Okay, but we didn't.
Right.
So are there enough good players in the AAA at Iron Pigs? And secondly, how did they come up with that name?
Because the answer to your first question is, the problem with blowing up the team now is the players don't have the value they had 2 years ago. You can't get for the older players what you might have gotten 2 years ago. So Ruben Amaro is kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. And if you were to bring up the kids from AAA, they, you know, some of them might eventually be stars. There are good players in the Philly system, but they're not going to be good right away. You're going to have to struggle for another year or two at least. I agree with you. I'm not saying you shouldn't blow up the team. I'm just saying it may be too late to get that much value. The name Iron Pigs comes from iron ore, which was mined in the Lehigh Valley years ago. And when they manufactured the iron, they came out in the form of little piglets. They looked like little piglets. So if you go, when you walk into the ballpark there, the first thing you see are a couple of, there's a display case with a couple of pieces of iron ore and a definition of an iron pig. The other great thing about that ballpark, I don't think I've ever said this about another ballpark or any place I've ever been in sports, that it has the most entertaining bathrooms I've ever been in. Because, as I said, everything in a minor league ballpark is sponsored. Well, the sponsor, at least 2 years ago in that ballpark, in the bathrooms, were the urology centers of the Lehigh Valley. So when you walk up, I'm not making this up. You walk up to a urinal, and the first thing you see is, been standing here since the anthem. It might not be the beer. The next one was, and then it says, urology centers of the Lehigh Valley. The next one says, has your bat gone silent? And then the next one says, the only place for dribblers in the ballpark are along the baselines. I mean, this is genius stuff. You cannot get this stuff at Citizens Bank Ballpark. Yes, over here, yes, sir.
It.
Thank you. I wish you'd wait till I'm done to read it.
And I've read several of your other books and have enjoyed them as well. I also am a big college basketball fan, and especially the Atlantic Coast Conference. And one of my favorite programs of all time has been University of North Carolina, mm-hmm. and with Dean Smith. And I'm just wondering, how is Dean Smith? I mean, he's a very private individual.
He's terrible. Is the honest answer? Mm-hmm. He has very, very serious dementia. He's in a wheelchair, and most of the time he doesn't know people anymore. It's a tragedy for anybody to go through that, and any family to go through that. But for Dean, Dean Smith had the sharpest mind of anybody I ever met. Dean Smith never once, after my children were born, said to me, "How are your children?" He'd say, "How are Danny and Bridget?" And Dean Smith, to me, may be the single person I admire most in sports. And just one quick story that sums Dean Smith up to me better than any. And there are a million stories I could tell, but the one that I remember vividly is in 1981, when I was working full-time at the Washington Post, I did a long profile on him. And he didn't want me to do it. It was always, write about the players, don't write about me. But I finally broke him down and got him to talk to me. And I went to talk to his minister at the Binkley Baptist Church in Chapel Hill, a man named Robert Seymour. And Reverend Seymour told me, nobody knew it at the time, but he told me that when Dean had been an assistant coach, when he first got to Chapel Hill, the restaurants were still segregated in 1958. And Dean, who came from Kansas and whose father coached the first integrated high school basketball team in the state of Kansas, found this appalling. And so he and Reverend Seymour came up with a plan for Dean to walk into a segregated restaurant with a black member of the church and sit down. And it's a small town. Even as the assistant coach, he was somebody important. He was Frank McGuire's assistant at North Carolina. And the management served them because they were afraid to tell the assistant basketball coach in North Carolina, no, you have to leave. And that was the beginning of integration in restaurants in Chapel Hill. And Dean continued to work on that, was recruited the first African-American player to North Carolina his first year. Not Charlie Scott. It was another player who played freshman ball. In those days, there was freshman ball. Now there isn't sophomore ball for many players. And he decided he didn't want to play. He wasn't a great player. But Dean was trying to make a point in 1962 because there were no black players in the ACC then. Maryland had one the next year, Billy Jones. But when I went back to ask Dean about this, you know, I said, can you tell me more about that night in the restaurant and what it was like and what you remember? He said, who told you that story? And I said, Reverend Seymour. And he said, I wish he hadn't told you that. And I said, why, Dean? You should be proud of doing something like that. And he said, John, you should never be proud of doing the right thing. You should just do the right thing. And those words have stuck with me for 33 years. And that's who Dean Smith was. I once asked Larry Brown what made Dean Smith special. He said, he's the single most decent man I've ever met in my life. What a great way to be described. So, but he's doing horribly, is the honest answer. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Have you been back to the China Doll, and do you stay in touch with those guys?
The China Doll is closed. The China Doll is the restaurant where Red Auerbach had lunch every Tuesday with a group of friends, and I was fortunate enough to be part of that group from 1999 until 2006 when Red died. By the time Red died, we had moved to another restaurant called Shanghai Village, and I had lunch with those guys today. Because the group has stayed together, still have lunch every Tuesday, still have it at 11 o'clock, because that's when Red wanted to have lunch at 11 o'clock, not because he was old, but because he liked to get to Woodmont to play cards as early as possible. And because I do radio now from 9 to 12, I can't go, but once a month, the guys move the lunch to 12:30 so I can go. And today was first Tuesday of the month, so the group is still together. And the only difference is we don't have Red's Celtics credit card anymore, so we have to take turns paying. But that I have extraordinary memories about those lunches and about Red. He was a remarkable guy. And the thing about Red was, for all of his toughness and gruffness, I'll tell you a tough gruff story, and then I'll tell you the real Red story. There was a writer named Peter Vesey. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of him. And Peter and Red just were arch enemies for years. Red used to put him in the hockey press box whenever he came to Boston. And he complained to the league, and David Stern called Red and said, you can't do that. You got to put him downstairs. Red said, no, it's my building. I'll do what I want in my building. So years later, Peter had a friend named Rob Ades, who was part of the lunch group. And one Tuesday, Rob came to Red and said, you know, Pete's going to be in Washington next week, and he'd really like to come to lunch. He really kind of wants to make amends for all that went on in the past. Let bygones be bygones. And Red said, as he always said when you asked if you could bring a guest, is he your friend? Rob said, yes. He said, then he's welcome to come. So the next Tuesday, it's pouring down rain. And Rob walks into the restaurant without Peter Vesey. And Red says, where's Vesey? I thought you were bringing him. He says, well, he wants to be absolutely sure that it's okay to come in and sit down. He's waiting outside. And Red says, does he have an umbrella? And Rob says, no, he doesn't. And Red says, let him wait a few minutes. But the flip side of Red is he became very close to my son, Danny. We used to go to GW games. Red was a graduate of George Washington went to games. One seat in the building painted red. That's red. All the other seats in the building are blue in the GW's home gym. And we'd go to games, and Danny and Red became very close. Red was kind of Danny's jock grandfather because neither of his grandfathers were into sports. And at the end of a game, Red would turn to Danny. Danny was like 7. Hey, Danny, want to go eat? And Danny go, yeah, Dad, we're going to go eat with Red. Okay, I guess I get to go along since. But one night, I said to Red, or one day at lunch, I said to Red, I need your help. Danny is making me crazy. He won't get up in the morning to go to school. It's just a battle. And if you call him and say, Danny, it's very important you get up in the morning and go to school, I think he'll listen to you. And Red said, no way. I said, what do you mean, no way? He said, I don't want him to get pissed off at me. That was Red.
John, you made a reference. I used to own a club in the Easter League, and you made a reference to a minor league umpire who I believe have the worst job in professional sports. And you made reference in the book about it. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about the horrific life that they have to go through every year.
Well, as I mentioned, Mark Lolo, who was one of the people I wrote about in the book, had worked for 11 years to work his way up from summer college ball to AAA to getting to work some major league games. And these guys are paid almost nothing. They have no home games. and umpires, referees, generally speaking, don't have home games, and they travel by car from game to game. And the International League is pretty spread out. The International League goes west to Indianapolis, to Louisville, to Columbus, and it goes as far south as Gwinnett, Georgia, and up to Pawtucket in Rhode Island. So they're in the car. He's got two young kids, this particular umpire, and they're on the road, 144 games. They're only 8 off days during a AAA baseball season. So they're on the road pretty much nonstop for 5.5 months and away from their families and making almost no money. And the reason they do it is because they have the dream, just like the players have the dream and coaches and managers have the dream. And one of the neat moments for me last year, after working with Arnie Baylor, who was the Pawtucket manager in 2012, was seeing him be part of the World Series celebration for the Red Sox, because he got moved up and was their first base coach. And he had never spent a day in the major leagues as a player, a manager, or as a coach until 2013. So those are kind of the neat stories that make doing a book like this so much fun. Thank you all very much for coming out.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.